Representative Mulry, welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. My understanding that somebody from the Representative Cornish would move 448 to the consent calendar, please.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 448 to be recommended to pass and put on the consent calendar.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Cornish.
Thank you, Representative Cornish and Mr. Chair. Members, just very briefly, this is not one that's just peace in the valley. It's everybody wants this and is organized to get rid of this. It's just repealing a statute that was put in. Sometimes the legislature makes mistakes. And this was a program that wasn't sought by the department, and it turned out to really backfire and cause a lot of problems. And so we suspended it by law and asked the department to see if there was another way to do it. And they did a thorough report on it and recommended that there was no way to really do it that was feasible. And so they don't want the program to go on, and I don't know of anybody, including every legislator I've talked to, is in favor of repealing it. So it's a very simple bill, and if there's any questions otherwise, I believe it is a true consent calendar item.
Thank you, Representative Mulry. Any questions to the bill? Okay. So they recommend... Say it again, Mr. Mulry.
The motion by Representative Cornish was to send it to the consent calendar.
Yeah, renew my motion.
Okay. Thank you for the help here. No further questions? Any? All members in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? The bill passes and is on its way. Thank you, Representative Mulry. Are we going to do your...
We're going to do the other two also.
Okay.
I believe somebody over there is going to recommend for the consent calendar number 230.
Mr. Chair, would it be 230? House File 230, I'm going to move that and recommend it to pass and be moved to the consent calendar.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Cornish. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mulry, when you're...
Members, John Zan Miller was... Oh, there. Come up. Mr. Chair and members, this is another one that there seems to be no question about. Apparently we just, again, when we were going through and adding into the predatory offender registration, we just happened to miss one statute which seems to be clearly a violent offense and a crime against the person, and that's when we added the strangulation on domestic abuse cases. Strangulation certainly meets the violence and crime against the person. And so that was left out when we did the other statute. And Mr. Zan Miller is a probation officer in Hennepin County and ran into the issue that wasn't included. So maybe he could just very briefly explain it to the committee.
Thank you, Representative Mulry. Representatives, I called Representative Mulry a few months ago and told him about the problem.
Sir, excuse me. Can you state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready.
John Zan Miller. I'm a probation officer with Hennepin County Community Corrections. Ladies and gentlemen, I had an offender on my caseload who had a 1960s adjudication for murder, a 1981 adjudication for criminal sexual conduct, and another violent felony involving a weapon in the 1980s. When he came onto my caseload, he was not required to register as a predatory offender because his offense predated registration laws. Now, had he been convicted, I had him on for domestic by strangulation, had he been convicted of a gross misdemeanor or felony level domestic assault, non-strangulation, been required to register as a predatory offender. However, I'm assuming that when the felony level domestic by strangulation was written, it was after you created the legislation that said that individuals convicted under this offense had to. Thankfully, with the offender that I had, I was able to find a gross misdemeanor domestic assault conviction in outstate Minnesota. That got the gentleman into the registration system. Ladies and gentlemen, I see felony level domestic by strangulation as being a very obvious indicator of future potential violence, sexual, physical, what have you. it's important that we have this group of people monitored effectively by Departments of Community Corrections and law enforcement where necessary.
And Mr. Chair, I would move the A2 amendments to get it into the shape. This is just correcting the effective date that was done by House research staff in conjunction with the Department of Public Safety.
Okay, thank you, Chair Mowry. Does everybody have the A2 amendment? Any questions regards to the A2 amendment? Okay. So everybody in favor of the A2 amendment, say aye.
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 Those opposed? Amendment passes. It is attached, so we have the bill before us in the condition. I hope you want it. Chair Mowry?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think unless there's questions, we could move on to the motion.
Okay. Is there any questions regards to Chair Mowry's bill before us here? Representative Cornish?
Mr. Chair, if there is none, I renew my motion to House File 230 be passed and as amended and put on the consent calendar.
Thank you, Mr. Cornish. All in favor of the motion, say aye.
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 Those opposed? House File 448 passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Thank you.
Sorry, we're working on this.
You're pretty good at that.
Well, thank you for your testimony, sir. Thank you. Okay, one more for our chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll move this one for
Chair Mowry Day here.
Mr. Chair, I would move House File 584 for layover and possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And I then move the DE3 amendment to get it in the shape the author wants.
Okay, so everybody have a copy of... Okay, so we have the 584 here, and then you have a delete-all?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, it's the DE3, and
okay.
We just need a vote on that first.
Okay, any questions regards to the delete-all amendment before us? I see none. All in favor of the amendment?
Aye.
Say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, amendment is adopted. We got the bill before us. Go ahead, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is the bill that was, we took all the testimony and questions with regard to the bill, but then we ran out of time at the meeting, and so this one was laid over. I talked to other members and nobody had any problems with this one. This is very straightforward. We heard about the real huge problems that sometimes occur where people are cutting out gas or other kinds of tubing and leaving it very dangerous. We have inspectors or police or fire that go into these houses, and then if their cell phone goes off, they can just explode along with the house, and it's extremely dangerous, and therefore we need to have much more of a penalty for that type of a dangerous situation that they leave it in rather than the mere theft of property that it would be otherwise. And unless there's some questions on this, we were at the point of, I think, of voting the last time. But
Chair Mowry, it looks like we have some questions. Representative Coles?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mowry, I like what you're doing here. I'm gonna support the bill, but I just have a question because I never have done criminal law work, and I'm not sure about the meaning of intentionality on 1.4. I guess I'm thinking of the guy. The guy who's digging a trench in his yard, doing some landscaping, and he's certainly intending to put the spade into the ground, and he busts the gas line. You know, he's not intending to bust the gas line, but he's intending to do what it was, what he was doing. I don't want to catch that person. I don't think you're intending to catch that person and convict him with a felony. I guess my request, Representative Mueller, is can you just take a look at that between now and whenever this thing moves out and make sure that that's the right word? I think it probably is, but if you can do that.
Chair Mueller, Representative Coles, I'll certainly go over that with you and the experts from House Research, but I see on line 1.6 without the consent, and in your case, he would be consenting to himself giving it.
Okay.
Representative Coles, so you're good?
For now, Mr.
For now.
Yeah.
Representative Chair Mulry?
I would renew my motion to... Or no, the chair can lay it over. That's what we want to do.
Any more questions?
You
just, okay. You so just if there's no more questions, the chair will lay this bill over for possible inclusion into the omnibus bill. Thank you.
I didn't know it was going to be the ominous bill. Representative Poppy, I believe you're the next one.
Do I have this? Did you want to hand it out?
Representative Poppy, would somebody like to move for a bill? And I believe it's for the floor, is that correct?
That's correct. I ask you to have an amendment as well.
Thank you, Representative Poppy. Let's make sure everybody's got it's House File 415, and it has been moved for passage and referral to the floor, or to the General Register. And Representative Poppy, you have an amendment. Is that the A3
yes,
amendment?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair.
Would you like to, or somebody move that amendment for her to get it in shape? Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson has moved the A3 amendment to get it into the shape that the author wants. All in favor of that, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Carries. Representative Poppy, now that that amendment has been adopted, and I've talked to the staff for both sides, it's my understanding now that we no longer have jurisdiction in this committee, and so then I believe the proper motion, rather than us, since we don't have jurisdiction now, that with your amendment on there, is that it be re-referred to the floor without recommendation. I believe that's the appropriate motion here. Since we no longer have jurisdiction, we can't recommend it, I guess. That's what I've been told. So if that's okay with you, then we would go ahead and vote on that motion to re-refer it without recommendation. Is that okay with the author?
I believe that would be okay.
Okay, then all in favor of that,
Chairman,
say...
Oh. Mr. Chairman, before we do that, just so I can understand, Representative Poppy, if I could, Mr. Chair...
Yes, Representative Coles.
Is your amendment okay with the hundreds of people that I've received emails from over the last couple of days in support of this bill?
The people,
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Coles. I believe you probably have gotten emails from people who are in support of the bill and people who are perhaps opposed to this language, at least, or opposed to the bill. And, yes, I believe this will take care of, I know from the racetrack owner that I represent, he is okay with this change in language.
Representative Coles, my understanding is that the people that initially asked for that sentence are okay with it being coming out, and so I've talked to their, what do we don't call them lobbyists, but whatever the nice name is, that it's okay with them.
Well, Mr. Chair, whether it's lobbyists or not, I'm just happy that we're taking care of all those people who emailed me. I want to have races down to Representative Poppy's district. Thank you.
Okay, all in favor of the bill, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. Thank you, Representative Poppy, for working it out and getting peace in the valley.
Thank you, Representative
Poppy. The next one would be House File 1033, Representative Simon.
Sheldon is getting that.
Representative Simon, you can move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that House File 1033 be passed and sent to the General Register.
And Representative Simon, there's no amendments to this one, is there?
No amendments.
Okay. Present your bill, Mr. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is an opportunity for us today to give some comfort and support to victims of violent crime. This effort started a few years ago with Representative Paymar of our committee here, who introduced and got passed the original legislation, which would allow spouses and next of kin of victims of a so-called heinous crime to get time off from work. Now, this is unpaid time off of work. This isn't France, 8 weeks paid vacation or anything like that. This is unpaid time off of work to attend criminal proceedings. So, in other words, the spouse or next of kin could be there for the aggrieved person or for the victim in a court proceeding. And at that time, there was no notable opposition, I'm told, from Representative Paymar, from really anyone. But it occurred to several people and several of the people with whom I've spoken over the last several months that the list of crimes included on there was small. In fact, if you look at the handout that you should have received here, there's a blue and a yellow handout that you should have in your pocket, in your packets. And the only difference between the two handouts is one listed by statute number and one listed by crime. But you'll see that under the current law, the only crimes, the so-called heinous crimes, for which this benefit is available, in other words, the only crimes where the spouse or next of kin can attend a criminal proceeding and get time off from work, unpaid time off of work, is murder one, murder two, murder three, assault, and then some of the criminal sexual conduct crimes, but only if force or violence is used or if the victim is a child. And it occurred to many folks, this has been working well and has really no opposition that I know of and that Representative Paymar knows of, that there are other crimes, also violent and equally important to look at, where the victims and their families are also deserving of the same protection. So all this bill does is add to the list. And you'll see here on the blue and yellow handouts, that's all the bill does. It adds these crimes. Now, you may be asking yourselves, how did you decide what's on the list? You know, why are some crimes on the list and why are some crimes not on the list? In working with some of the people you're going to hear from in just a moment, and some of the advocates and others in the community, obviously you have to draw lines all the time. The line that we drew after talking with some folks is crimes that were mostly felonies, almost all of these are felonies, crimes that are against individuals, and crimes that are typically or usually violent crimes. Now, let me tell you what's not on the list, in case you think we just sort of cut and paste and put a list together that had no rhyme or reason. What's not on the list are crimes like violating an order for protection, restraining order, harassment, coercion, terroristic threats, financial exploitation, etc. There are many others. So I hope you don't get the impression that we just sort of cut and paste and put all felonies on there. These are felonies that are particularly violent and that are against individuals and specific people. And so this is just giving some protection, some comfort, some aid, some support to the victims of violent crime and just expanding that list. Again, this year there's no known opposition. No one's talked to me or any of the advocates that I know of. Many of the members on both sides of the aisle on this committee are co-authors on the bill, and I appreciate that, thanks to those who signed on the bill. And I want to thank many people for their cooperation, including the two who you're going to hear from. And let me just hand it over then to Jennifer Notice of the General Crime Victims Coalition for some testimony.
Ms. Notice.
Thank you, Chair Committee. My name is Jennifer Notice, and I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota General Crime Victim Coalition. I appreciate you taking the time to hear from me today. I will be brief. The overwhelming message I'd like to leave you with today is that all victims of crime, regardless of whether they're heinous, as described by the statute, need the support of an individual at all points during a case. And especially the most frustrating times we often find for victims are those times in which they have to go through the criminal process. And so what this bill does is it allows victims to have that support person there. It takes away the hindrance of having to deal with their work schedule or having them to deal with harassment or retaliation from their employer so that they can be there for that victim during those proceedings. As Representative Simon described, we did go through the list, and these are the crimes that we feel the victims need to have the support person there during the criminal proceedings the most. Doesn't mean that they're more serious than the other crimes. Doesn't mean that the victims need to be assisted any greater than the other ones. It's just that they're so serious in nature that they just really strike us as those in which a support system would be able to assist them, or that maybe they have some difficulty in making that appropriate connection with the advocate where that support system is their only force there for them. So I would ask and encourage you to pass this bill as it is written. Realistically, the bill isn't going to be having an influx of individuals trying to get away from work. Realistically, most support people can use vacation time or their sick leave to get off of work to attend criminal proceedings if they need to. What we find is those individuals who work in the service industry who don't have those benefits are finding the greatest retaliation from their employers and are being threatened with their job if they try to take off time to support another individual during the criminal proceedings. So again, I thank you for your time, and I encourage you to pass this bill. Thank you.
Representative Simon,
thank
did you say you had somebody else?
One more person. Thank you.
Fairly short, since there's no question.
Oh, a very short testimony here. I'll let the witness introduce herself.
My name is Dorian Eder. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. Thank you for having me. I would just like to second
Ms. Eder.
Jennifer said. This is not an overwhelming population. We don't have people beating down our doors saying that this is a crisis out there. But when it's happening to you, this is a serious issue. So if you're the parent of an 18-year-old girl whose boyfriend strangled her, if your elderly mother was sexually abused in a nursing home, by expanding the list of crimes, we're not talking about every crime. We're talking about some fairly serious and heinous crimes. Also keeping in mind that often the victim is not going to be allowed to remain in the courtroom and observe the proceedings because the victim is a witness. So when you have a living victim, someone being there from the family to be able to observe all of the proceedings is pretty critical to putting the pieces back together when the criminal case is over.
Okay, Representative Simon, do you want to just renew the motions? Representative Simon renews his motion. Is there any discussion of it before? Okay, then all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Carries. Thank you, Representative Simon. Representative Atkins. No. Thank you. Representative Atkins, is somebody going to move this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the bill.
Representative Smith moves the bill of, let's see, what is it? 1251. Representative Atkins, do you want to present your bill?
I'd be happy to, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and members, the goal here is just to have people get what they pay for when they buy insurance. This is good faith and direct action. In simple terms, what good faith does, by the way, there's 46 other states now that have good faith laws on the books. And all it says is that insurance companies cannot unfairly delay or deny handling your claim. That's about all there is to good faith. And it's got overwhelming support. There's going to be some folks you'll hear from today on why we need it. But that's all the good faith that legislation does. And by the way, it's not just to help injured people. It's also for homeowners with mold claims. It's for businesses trying to get insurance claims paid. That's all that it does is just cause insurance companies. And by the way, 99% of the time, that's exactly what insurance companies do, is they process claims without delay and without inappropriate denial. We're just getting after those 1% or 2% that give a black eye to everybody else. So that's the good faith portion. The direct action part of this is what Wisconsin does, by the way, and this is just honesty in litigation. It requires that the insurance company be named on the court filing documents and as a party in the claim. So when there's Joe Atkins versus Sheldon Johnson, it says Joe Atkins versus Sheldon Johnson and Allstate Insurance Company. It's not a big deal. It just simply says what people kind of already know anyway, which is that there's an insurance company involved. The fact is, folks, is the insurance company is calling the shots already. You know, they're telling you whether or not you can settle your claim. Even if Sheldon Johnson wanted to say, I want this claim settled and I want you to settle it for X, the insurance company is still going to tell them, no, we're not going to do that. Here's what we're going to do. Here's how we're going to try the case. Here's the lawyer we're going to hire. Here's how we're going to move forward with this. If they're calling all the shots, they ought to be identified as one of the parties. The other thing is, every once in a while, and this is the final point that I'll make before we get some testimony, you'll see one of these goofy claims where you got like a 3-year-old suing mom and dad, or some other family member suing family members, and the jury's looking at it like, what in the world? You know, it's just some warring family that can't get along. What it is there's an insurance dispute. And rather than have jurors go back into the jury room and spend their first half hour trying to figure out why this 3-year-old kid or 3-year-old kid's grandma hates the parents and what in the world is going on here, immediately the jury's going to know that it's over an insurance dispute. Their job is to figure out how the coverage should apply and go from there. That's all that this does. It's good faith. It's direct action. And with that, we do have a couple folks that would like to be heard from today, and then I'd love to stand for your questions or concerns.
Representative Atkins, would you present your witnesses then?
They're on their way, Your Honor. And I'm not sure what order. I see we've got Mr. Messerly. Okay.
Oh. Let's see. Do you want to introduce them, Representative Atkins?
I would be happy to. This is Chris Messerly from Robbins, Kaplan, Miller, and Streese.
Mr. Messerly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm also president of the Minnesota Trial Lawyers Association, and I will not repeat what has been said in an adequate summary, but I will say that the good faith bill is really for the benefit of all consumers, and I don't mean just individuals. Just by way of example, 3M brought a claim in hopes of encouraging their insurance company to act in good faith. I think just a basic human property that people owe each other. Insurance companies are considered persons under the law, and it seems to me just a basic entitlement that all of us, whether we're a corporation or individuals, have an expectation that we're treated in good faith, and that's all that is. On the direct action, I think it is basically a truth in litigation. I mean, it's been a long while that the insurance companies have been the guy behind the curtain in the corner. I mean, it's the insurance companies that do everything. They even stifle some honesty somewhat. I mean, if I cause an accident and it's my fault, I'd like to say I'm sorry, I'm responsible for that. But I'm told by my insurance company, as of all of you who have an insurance policy, that no, you can't be forthcoming and be honest about that. You can't acknowledge your fault because you'll violate your policy. So it's just an issue to show the truth and honesty of the whole litigation situation. They're the only people paying. It's not the insured, typically, that are paying anything. So I don't think either of these are controversial, particularly on the good faith. The reason I don't think that, I can't imagine that's controversial, because all an insurance company has to do is treat people fairly and in good faith. And if they do that, they have nothing to worry about.
Representative Atkins, I believe you have one more witness.
We do, Mr. Chair. Mr. Golino from Mendota Heights is here also.
Mr. Golimo?
Golimo, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you for listening to me today. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. My family and I had a home built in Mendota Heights in 1996, and within a few years we started having water intrusion issues, and it was pretty clear that we also were going to have some mold issues, which were identified. In trying to remediate the mold issues, we then realized that we had some pretty significant architectural issues with the home, and it took about a year when we actually had to leave our home and live in an apartment of remediation work to get things fixed. Obviously, at the start of that process, we contacted the builder, who contacted his insurance company, an adjuster was assigned, and it was pretty clear after the first 3 to 6 months of working with the adjuster that his basic purpose was to try to figure out the absolute minimum number of dollars that could be spent to make us go away and basically just, you know, consider the case to be closed. So let me just give you some examples. He would come out and, you know, there were some specific windows that had been identified as having issues. So his recommended solution was to address those issues, take them out, put them back in, fix the stucco, and then said that would take care of the problem. Unfortunately, you know, we decided to go ahead and fund the work on our own because it was clear we weren't going to get any help from the insurance company. And we eventually found out that 80% of the windows had problems versus the 10% that he wanted to fix initially. So if we had not done that, we would have not remediated the issues. during the course of this process, her son developed some health issues because of an allergy to mold, and we wouldn't have addressed those issues either, which actually would have been potentially life-threatening in that case. In another case, he had suggested that we not take the stucco off of the structure that was supporting the deck, and we decided to go ahead and do that, and when we did, the deck actually fell partially and was just about ready to come off the back of the house. So it was pretty clear that, again, his recommendations were based on just minimizing the cost outlay from the insurance company. We actually went ahead and filed a claim with the Department of Commerce, and after a few months of working with them, they basically came back and said, you know, there isn't a lot we can do here. It's kind of a he said, she said, because we don't have any documentation. And, of course, they were very clear and very good about not creating any documentation for us. Another issue that happened with the insurance company is they, right before the case was to go to trial, they filed a countersuit where they claimed that they didn't have any coverage liability in our case, which, you know, clearly was meant to just be an intimidating factor to try to get additional leverage in the mediation process. So, in my opinion, you know, this is a legislation that needs to be in place and would have definitely helped us in the case that I'm just referring to.
Thank you, Mr. Galimo. Representative Atkins is at the end. Representative Coles, I was going to take the testimony from each side and then open it to questions. And is that my understanding is, are you done then with, or?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I think there are some folks here that want to argue that they should be able to do bad faith. there are some other folks that desire to testify.
Yes, Representative Atkins, we have three people that have asked, and your side got 12 minutes, so we'll give them 12 minutes to. I'm not sure if you can characterize them as bad faith. I'm not sure what they might be entitled to characterize you as. But would the opponents, David Diedrichs, Bob Johnson, and Richard Thomas, those are the three that are listed. So if you could get up there and start out. And Representative Atkins, you may want to have your witnesses by for questions when we're done with this. Are you Mr. Diedrichs?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. I'm not.
Oh, you're?
My name is Richard Thomas.
Oh, Richard Thomas.
And people were sending me up here from the audience, and I'm pleased to be here. I am the past president of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association, and I'm currently its co-chair of its Law Improvement Committee. I am not in favor of bad faith, but neither am I in favor of certain aspects of this bill. Let me talk about the direct action part first. It's true that there are states that have it. There are only two. Wisconsin is one, and Louisiana is another. I think it's pretty clear that although this concept is being paraded as an attempt to encourage honesty, it isn't. What it really is an attempt to depersonalize the litigation so that it is perceived by the supporters of this bill that by naming the insurance company, it is easier for a jury to award a recovery because it's depersonalized. I would suggest to you that that's a bad idea for several reasons. First of all, it insults our jury system. Our jurors don't need for the cause of action to be depersonalized so that they can treat it fairly. For most of the history of our state, the mention of insurance has been deemed to be sufficiently potentially prejudicial that a mistrial results. It would be truly strange, and it is strange to me, to think that this body is entertaining to legislate a practice which for years and years has been deemed to be inappropriate and improper. The insurance company is not necessarily or simply the man behind the curtain. The insurance company isn't driving the car, it isn't running the red light, it isn't causing the damage. There is no reason to add the name of the insurance company as a party to the litigation, because all of the issues can be decided by the jury without ever knowing that and without prejudice. When we talk about honesty, should we also tell the jury when there isn't insurance? Should we tell the jury that the defendant is going to be placed into bankruptcy if they awarded an amount in X amount? Of course not. None of those issues have anything to do with resolving the fundamental issues before that court. Duty, breach, causation, and damages. If you depersonalize the jury system, you are causing a great disservice to justice itself. Since the time of the Greeks, the statue of justice has had a blinder on. That blinder is there for a reason, to ensure fairness. There is no necessity to remove the blinder if the only reason is to encourage greater verdicts. Now I want to talk about, momentarily, about the bad faith litigation bill. Minnesota has bad faith causes of action. They're in third-party situations, so that if I'm sued and the carrier doesn't want to settle my case and I think it should be settled and we demand it settled and an amount comes in excess of the verdict, the insurer can and is liable under the state, under the current common law in the state of Minnesota for bad faith. What isn't currently available in Minnesota is bad faith in a first-party setting. Now, what this bill does is it changes really everything, because it isn't just addressing that sliver of cases where we don't have bad faith, and someone might argue we should, that is in a first-party setting where you have a UIM situation or an uninsured motorist situation where you're trying to recover from your own insurance company for your damages. What this bill does is it takes what is the Fair Claims Practices Act, which our Supreme Court has said does not create a private cause of action, and it creates a cause of action for every disgruntled insured with every claim. And in addition to that, it changes how you prove bad faith. Currently under Minnesota law, under Short versus Dairyland, how you prove bad faith in Minnesota has been subject to many appellate decisions and has been refined over the years. This takes that standard and abandons it. It creates basically a new industry for causes of action, and to encourage that new industry, it provides for the payment of attorney's fees. So that if you have a disgruntled insured who is unhappy with a small aspect of the manner in which that claim was handled, an attorney can be encouraged to bring that case, even though it isn't meritorious or financially viable on its own, because the person can collect the attorney's fees for doing so. And it also takes, in that third-party setting that I've told you about, that already exists, gives attorney's fees in those cases as well. I'm reminded of a statement of a wiser lawyer than myself who once said, you know, Rich, to threaten lawyers with litigation is like threatening a farmer with a good crop. So in one sense, as a defense lawyer who's been defending these claims, I almost am tempted to say, bring it on. But on the other side, in terms of fairness, I think you have to look very carefully as to whether or not you want to create this new industry, and in creating the new industry, whether you want to encourage it by providing an award of attorney's fees in every particular claim, when that has not been necessary for many, many years in this state when we're dealing with third-party bad faith claims. That doesn't just make the plaintiff whole. That makes the plaintiff whole plus. That will give the plaintiff more money than the plaintiff would have recovered had there been insurance in place for the entire amount, and we oppose it for those reasons. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Diedrich. Are the other two, Mr. Thomas? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Diedrich's or Bob Johnson, I see. Either one of you. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. And I'm Patrick Sauter. I'm with the Ryder Bennett Law Firm, and I practice in the area of bad faith or good faith litigation, whatever you want to term it.
Mr. Johnson, do you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'll be brief, although it's unfortunate with 12 minutes, because this is a significant issue that significantly changes insurance litigation that's going to affect every consumer in the state that buys an auto, a homeowner policy, or any business that buys any type of liability insurance. It is a dramatic and significant bill that's going to have bottom line financial ramifications for every citizen of the state that's in the insurance marketplace. And we'll, in a couple of minutes, try to present that, Mr. Chairman, and probably follow up. But I'd like to just describe a fact scenario for the committee and then ask you to think about it. We won't have time to try to work it into House File 1251, but I dialed back a couple of years to Maurer County when a bowling alley burned down. Total complete fire loss. The fire was investigated by the state fire marshal's office. Found that it was a suspicious origin. A suspicious origin means that somebody set the fire. It's arson. The key thing is whether or not the owner did the arson. So the insurer on that case denied the claim, as they should have, because we don't want to pay arsonists when they burn their properties down. And so the fire marshal found suspicious origin. The company denied the claim. The individual initiated civil litigation under the policy to collect the proceeds. And in fact, came up here to the legislature and testified in the House and Senate. I don't remember his name, but we could find that. In support of a bill that looked very similar to House File 1251. Then it was called a bad faith civil litigation bill. Testified that he was unreasonably treated. He should have been paid the policy proceeds. And in fact, was crying in the room at the time, fairly emotional, because this bowling alley burned down. It was a $300,000 fire loss. Well, so what happened about the 6 weeks or so before that ended? That gentleman in the bowling alley owner was criminally convicted of arson in the first degree and sentenced to jail. Well, it seems that that was probably an appropriate decision to not pay that claim. And Mr. Chairman and committee members, I think from our industry's perspective, anything that puts a damper on the industry's attempts to fight arson, fraud, and we believe that this bill is materially going to do that. Because of the standards in it, because of the ambiguity in the language as to what is an insurer held to in that instance of those decisions. And frankly, I think Mr. Thomas talked about the direct action. We oppose that. It is an extreme remedy that's not found in America. Okay, two states do direct action. And frankly, if you look at the case law in Minnesota, there is no question the majority of states in America have a first party. They're called bad faith causes of action. But the standards in those court cases, as you look around the country, are like the standard that you find in Wisconsin. There was a Supreme Court case, Anderson versus Continental Insurance in 1978, and it's the standard that I believe is in 25 states for the action. It talks about the absence of a reasonable basis for denying the benefits of a policy, the insurer's knowledge or reckless disregard of the lack of a reasonable basis for denying the claim. In other words, it's a more significant standard of an intentional, deliberate, reckless action on the part of the insurer. And those are words, Mr. Chairman and committee members, that are found in other Supreme Court cases. So, with that, Mr. Chairman, from the industry's perspective, we believe that, A, we support good faith. And one of the ironies or one of the interesting sidebars is that the law in Minnesota that governs the handling of every claim, Minnesota Statutes Chapter 72A.201, I think if you get a moment and look at the very specific claim standards, response times, the whole process of the claim is governed by law. That law, which has stood on the books in Minnesota for quite some time, was written way back when Governor Perfich, and the law was written by former Commerce Commissioner Mike Hatch. Mike Hatch wrote, drafted, and I think everybody here knows full well. We didn't have our way, we didn't push, in fact, we didn't draft it. It was drafted by Commerce Commissioner Mike Hatch. It has stood on our books. The Unfair Claim Settlement Practices Act. So, Mr. Chairman, we believe that the consumers are protected. We have a remedy in place. The litigation that's going to get spawned out of this. I'll end with this because I know we're out of time, but there's a study that West Virginia did. The legislature mandated their commerce commissioner a year ago to do a study of what's going on with third party causes of action on the West Virginia insurance markets. I just urge the committee to read this study. West Virginia had pretty extensive, wide-open, third-party, bad-faith causes of action, and they got rid of it based on this study, looking at the uniqueness of what was happening in West Virginia. And at the end of them repealing this law, insurance rates, auto, homeowners, liability dropped across the board some $70 million. It was about 10% in the West Virginia system. So Do these laws cost consumers money? Absolutely. I don't think there's any question about it. Here is at least one live current example in the state that had it, got rid of it, and the industry was required to file rate reductions because, and there was an excess of $70 million, and so in terms of the proportions to the market, if the numbers would be considerably bigger in Minnesota. If that 10% is even ballpark, we have a $3.5 billion auto insurance system premium-wise, so 10% is $350 million. So, Mr. Chairman, we don't think that House File 1251 is necessary. We've got consumer remedies in place, and we think we should keep those remedies. Thank you.
Mr. Johnson, there's just one thing you said, not found America. A lot of people in Minnesota that grew up in Wisconsin do think they're in America, where they grew up, but... there's only about a minute left. We can give you a couple minutes extra if you...
All right. My name is Patrick Sauter. Mr. Chairman, thank you for listening to me and the committee. I think the legislation is well-intentioned, but it's unnecessary. It strikes me it's going to be very expensive to implement, and in its current state, the language it uses strikes me to be unworkable. As has been already stated, and I won't repeat it, Minnesota has an established bad faith system in place for third-party action. In fact, I see some people in the audience that have been on the other side of me on cases and have served as experts in giving testimony in those type of cases. But in our bad faith situation now, the third-party bad faith, the insurance company, when they violate that fiduciary duty, can be held to pay the entire verdict. So in the Short versus Dairyland case, that amounted to, I believe, 30 times more than their policy limit. In other cases I've been involved in, that penalty can amount to 80 or 100 times their policy limit. So there is teeth in the current state of the law. It does work. And I would only point out the first-party bad faith is already addressed, members of the committee, in our Fair Claims Practice Act under Statute 72A.201 et al. And I think that the language being proposed here, it doesn't erase that Fair Claims Practice Act. It's going to make it so complicated, because which standard applies? Is it the language in this statute, or is it going to supersede the other one? So unless there's questions, I would say this is an unnecessary piece of legislation and likely to be very expensive to implement.
Thank you, Mr. Sauter. Marcus Marsh also wanted to testify, but we're out of time. We had to limit the time so that the committee has time for questions, and I believe there's at least one amendment, so... First, we would go to questions, and Representative Coles, and then Lesh. So, Representative Coles.
Well, Mr. Chair, I can certainly ask my questions, or if you want to take my amendment now, the amendment's very simple.
We can do the amendment first.
I don't know. Has the amendment been passed out?
Yes. Okay. It's the A1, I assume.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, the amendment that I have, the A1 amendment, is very simple. If you go to line 3.16 of the Atkins bill, it provides that for the bad faith cause of action, that it is effective for causes of action commenced or pending on or after August 1st of 2007. Mr. Chair and members, I don't believe that I've ever seen us apply civil litigation standards, new standards, this broadly to pending litigation. The amendment simply strikes that or pending language. It would allow for this cause of action to occur or to be brought for claims commenced after August 1st. But right now, as the bill is drafted, any case that's currently working its way through the court system, or maybe cases that haven't even been filed yet in court, but a summons and complaint have been served, an amended complaint could be brought adding this claim. We don't do that we haven't done it before that I'm aware of. I don't think we should do it here. And so that's the amendment, and I would move it at this time.
Representative Coles, first I would ask Representative Atkins for your response.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Coles, a couple points. One is that you're essentially arguing then that if folks wanted to act in bad faith in pending actions, they could still do that through August 1st. but not in, in future actions. And I think if we're going to adopt good faith, we ought to adopt good faith, not just for future actions, but for ones that are currently currently taking place. So that would be my my primary response.
Anybody else want to comment on it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just would note that the amendment does nothing to encourage bad faith now or in the past, and the bill talks about actions commenced on or after. I'm sure Representative Atkins, he's a very clever plaintiff's personal injury lawyer. He can come up with some good scenarios under which we're going to run against a statute of limitations issue in a handful of cases. But if somebody really wants to assert this cause of action and it passes the legislature this year and is signed into law, they can bring their claim after August 1st and assert this cause of action. So it doesn't do anything to encourage bad faith, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Atkins.
Just one other brief point, and that is, I quote Mr. Sauter. He's the one that said we already got really strong laws on this anyway, so that you know, that are already in application of these folks that are in pending actions. I don't think that they should be surprised that they have to be acting in good faith, and I'd suggest that that it's not a good amendment to add.
Okay. Representative Westrom.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, who's out there to be helped? It's almost like there's a lawsuit pending that somebody's trying to help out here. Are you aware of any lawsuits that would be benefiting from this?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrom, no one in particular has a pending action where they've said this would apply to me. But you just heard from Mr. Galeno, who's sitting here. He had a claim ongoing that was abused by the insurance company and by the adjuster. And if a case happens to be in suit, I don't think that they should not be afforded the protections of good faith. So whether it's pending or not, I think they ought to have that protection. And I would think, I suspect that most of the folks in the insurance world, that, and granted we had a couple of people comment here, but I think most of the folks in the insurance world would argue that they should be held to a good faith standard too. They don't want the black eye of having that the bad actor or a couple bad actors that are out there doing bad business to folks give them a black eye.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, as Mr. Johnson and the other witnesses explained, the insurance companies are already held to a good faith standard under the Fair Claims Practices Law. This amendment or the language or pending really is about getting attorney's fees to people. That bad faith standard already exists, and so it's really about providing attorney's fees to a handful of pending claims. We can go forward. We haven't done this in the past that I'm aware of, and I don't think we should do it now. I'll leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
I think everyone's ready to vote then. A vote in favor is a vote for Cole's amendment. Okay, all in favor of the Cole's amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay.
No.
No. I believe the noes carry. Okay, then we are back to the bill.
I have some questions, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Coles, I believe, I'll come back to you next. We have Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question is for Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson told a story about the guy that burned down the bowling alley, $300,000 in losses. And I guess from my understanding, he got convicted later on, and I don't practice civil litigation, so I don't know how this works, but I haven't heard of too many civil suits that are solved in advance of a criminal suit. And so I wonder, in this case, obviously it was bad faith and it was established bad faith. So, Mr. Johnson, my question is, how would your story have applied to this, considering it was already determined by a jury that, in fact, he did burn down his own bowling alley? The insurance company went forward based upon a hunch in advance, but the real work was done by a jury. So how does your story apply to this, considering he was already found guilty by a jury of his peers?
Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chairman, I was describing the sequencing. Perhaps I wasn't clear. That when the gentleman who owned the bowling alley came to the legislature to testify for a bill very similar to I wasn't aware, and there surely was nothing at the legislature, that there was some criminal investigation underway, which I saw then was underway. So his testimony was earlier in the year. Later in that same session, he was criminally convicted. My only point was this. The company denied the claim because the state fire marshal investigated after it burned down, issued a report, and concluded it was of suspicious origin. Which, frankly, has happened a number of times in the last 25 years up here, when three separate bad faith bills have come to the legislature, and in every instance, they involve fire claims. The last time was 1995, with former Senator Dallas Sams, who was the chief author of the bill in a bowling alley that burned down in Staples, Minnesota. That after he testified at the Senate Commerce Committee, a jury in Hennepin County found that he had deliberately set the fire. So my only point is that when an individual contends that their insurance company has treated them unreasonably or unfairly by denying a claim, these are express examples where post the testimony, all you can know is what's presented when the individual comes up here. I don't know anything beyond that. And what it demonstrated is that, frankly, it was denied for a good reason. The company did consumers a favor by trying to stop payment to someone who was guilty of a crime and wanted their policy proceeds. They're not entitled to their policy proceeds when they're guilty of crimes like that.
Representative Lesch, do you have a follow-up? Representative Atkins, you wanted to respond.
To that point, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lesch, Mr. Johnson, they can still deny for a good reason, even if this passes. That's the whole point. It's just it says that you can't, you've got to have a reasonable basis for your offer, for your delay, or your denial. Certainly if you're in the midst of a fraud investigation, that's a pretty good basis. It's just that you can't be unreasonable in that offer or delay or denial. That's all this does.
Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Atkins, to that very point, so would a report from the state fire marshal saying that a fire is suspicious be an objectively reasonable basis to deny a claim?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I guess I'd have to look at the report. I guess the point is we give this basis to jurors all the time. In fact, this is the way that we present most cases to juries, is to make up their mind whether or not they acted reasonably or not. And as long as they're acting reasonably and have an objective basis for denial or delay, they can still do that. This just gets after those folks that are being completely unreasonable, like what Mr. Glimo ran into.
Representative Coles.
Could I ask a question of Mr. Thomas from the MDLA?
Yes. Any other witnesses? Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Thomas, on this issue of objectively reasonable, I mean, to me, that sounds like an invitation not only for jury questions in many or all cases that are brought, because I assume that an attorney would in most instances probably not be representing his or her client as he or she should without putting a bad faith cause of action into the complaint. But it seems to me that type of language is also going to lead to appellate litigation as the courts try to figure out what objectively reasonable is or isn't. Can you comment on that?
Mr. Thomas.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, I'll try. The law defines reasonable as what a prudent person would do under like circumstances. That is an inherently difficult thing to determine. Lawsuits are tried every day based upon that question, and coins are flipped. Sometimes they come up heads, and sometimes they come up tails. So if you have a situation, if you're going to create a new legal industry whereby I can flip the coin, and if it comes up heads, I get my attorney's fees paid. I'm going to be alleging, if I'm a plaintiff's attorney, in virtually every one of these cases, that the manner in which this particular claim was handled was unreasonable. And if you get six or seven people to say, yeah, I think it was unreasonable, not only do you win the day, but you get your attorney's fees paid too. It is an enormous economic incentive to bring bad faith claims, which is why most states require more than an unreasonable standard. To be bad faith, it implies something more than you made a mistake. Unreasonable conduct can be simply, I made a mistake and I overlooked something. That meets the standard of unreasonable. You can't punish an industry with that standard. They won't be able to do their jobs. That's why bad faith claims usually require some element of an intentional bad conduct. And that's not in this bill.
Mr. Chair, my question is more specific than that, I think. Mr. Thomas, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that term objectively reasonable. Well, the scenario I posited to Representative Atkins about the fire marshal's report, that may or may not be reasonable. I don't think we know that until the Minnesota Supreme Court tells us. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Thomas, I believe your question is to?
Yes.
Mr. Thomas?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Coles, I think you're right. This is going to be have to, this is, all of this new legislation is going to have to be modified, clarified, and interpreted by our Court of Appeals and by our Supreme Court. There's going to be a great deal of litigation, both on the district court level and on the appellate level and the Supreme Court level, to determine what in fact this all means.
Representative Chair, I have been doing a good job of leading your own witness.
I only have one or two more questions for Mr. Messley, if he could come back. But Representative Atkins has.
Representative Atkins should have a chance to respond.
I was just wondering if Mr. Thomas wanted a bat to hit those softballs with. Mr. Chair, pardon the phrase, but what a load of crud. This is to have, I mean, that is one of the most insulting things, Mr. Thomas, that I've ever heard. That people are in jury rooms flipping coins to figure out what's reasonable or not, it's an absolute, utter insult to those people that serve on juries. And I hope that wasn't what you intended, but that's certainly what you implied. We have this basis, we've had it for 150 years in Minnesota, about a reasonable standard. There's no, what a load to think that this would have to be heading off to the Court of Appeals and to the State Supreme Court to tell us what reasonable means. That's what we ask jurors to do. We've done it for 150 years in Minnesota. We've done it back well beyond that in this nation and in all nations that have this standard. A final point that this approach takes, that this is going to lead to greater litigation and all kinds of an explosion. For heaven's sakes, folks, look at the other 46 states that have it. It has not led to an explosion of litigation. Moreover, it's designed to decrease litigation because it causes folks to act with reasonable basis in denying and delaying claims. If anything, it will lead to a decrease in litigation.
Mr. Messerly, I believe Representative Coles has a question. Is that correct?
Yes.
For you? And could you try to?
Time, Mr. Chair.
We're going to vote today. So
I
just,
are. I'm not.
Go ahead.
I'm trying to prevent a vote.
Okay.
And
Representative.
I'm going to use Representative Atkins' term. I think I heard him right. I think it was a load of crud or something like that. Mr. Messerly, I heard you testify to this committee that insurance policies require people to lie. And Mr. Messerly, that's a load of crud. I'm aware, Mr. Messerly, that insurance policies have cooperation clauses, but I am not aware of a single insurance policy, and I hope you can provide this committee with one, because what you testified to this committee is that insurance policies require insureds to lie. Can you provide us with a single policy that says, an insured is required to lie?
Mr. Chair, Representative Coles, I think if you view the transcript or replay this, you'll hear that I say that some policies require that people not admit liability. That's what I said. And what it does is deter people from being as honest and frank as they'd like to. The fact of the matter is, if an insurance company acts fairly and in good faith, that it is an absolute and complete defense. You'd have no worries for an insurance company if you act in good faith. It's that simple. And that's all that's being asked of an insurance company is you'd expect of any human being. And because insurance companies are human beings, or at least persons under the law, they should treat us that way and should treat corporations like 3M that way, as we expect to treat each other here. So that's all I said.
Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's so fun when we have a room full of lawyers disagreeing. I just love it. But I'm going to try and take this back to the suburban soccer mom realm here. And I have a question for the author and then also a question for Mr. Johnson from the insurance group. Representative Atkins, do you support higher insurance costs?
for Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holbrook, I just want to get what I paid for. That's all this does.
And Mr. Chair, have you had an opportunity to review the study that Mr. Johnson referenced in West Virginia about the additional costs relative to this type of policy?
Representative Atkins.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Holbrook, for bringing that up. That was the first time I've seen that study. I wish Mr. Johnson would have shared it with me previously. That said, I have seen insurance rates across the country. And remember now, 46 other states have this in place. And nobody's talked about how it makes that big of a difference. What makes a difference in your insurance rates is if you crash your car. And do that. That's what affects underwriting, and that's what affects your insurance rates. It's not going to be just asking people to act in good faith.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I don't know that I totally agree. I mean, we've heard very clearly that the state policy for no-fault insurance has cost our ratepayers more than more standard types of auto insurance, and that's a policy we have implemented at the legislature that has cost consumers more. So I'm not completely in line with that there's no direct effect of what we do here on insurance rates.
Mr. Chair, I can address the difference. And the difference is that we have different limits, we have different requirements with regard to that that differ from 49 other states. Good faith in some is in place in 46 other states. Essentially, this sort of language is in place in 46 other, not different limits or different requirements, essentially the same.
And Mr. Chair, that's a good segue to my question for Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Johnson, can you come up? But you're going to have to be shorter on your answers than before.
And Mr. Chair, and Mr. Johnson, I believe in your testimony you talked about a range of language that this may be more onerous than other states, and that, you know, we've heard 46 states have this policy, and that you use, I think, a number of 20. Could you explain how this language relates to the other 46 states?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holbrook, what I was trying to point out was that this standard in House File 2012-51 is uniquely different than the first party bad faith triggering language in what we find around America. I cited a Wisconsin Supreme Court case. And so while other states have it, they do not have this language, and of course 48 states don't have any direct action, so this is unique. So my comment is that the experience or costs in other states is going to be different because what triggers the bad faith is decidedly different. In most of those states, as Mr. Thomas had indicated, has a more of the deliberate, intentional, reckless disregard. It's not just a reasonable test. So I think, as Mr. Atkins had pointed out, we surely know in civil litigation the reasonableness test, but that's not what first-party bad faith laws and common law development have happened. About a dozen states have it in statute. The rest have common law. The courts found this remedy. They defined it, and it's a much more higher, more egregious conduct. If that answers your question.
And just real briefly, and this will be my last thought. Just in your general review of this issue, if you were to put a spectrum of the 1 to 46, 1 being the most loose standard, if you will, and 46 being the tightest, where would this language fall on that spectrum of the 46 states that have this?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm hesitant to put a number. This is a unique remedy. This is not found around America. It is not tested language, and the direct action against states just flat don't do that. I think the dilemma here, by respect to Attorney Atkins here, is that this is not tested language, and the point of the matter is I don't know that a fire marshal's report that says it's suspicious origins, I would hope it's an objectively reasonable basis, but until we get that decreed through the legal system, we don't know that.
Representative Kranz?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually appreciate a great deal when Representative Holbrook speaks from a more normal position as a suburban hockey dad. I appreciate that. We at least are on
some of us were just insulted, but
I do have a question maybe for Mr. Johnson. I'm trying to figure out, it seems to me that the real debate is on the definition of good faith and whether it's maybe a practical definition or a legal definition, and I'm trying to wade through all those things in my mind. But I think when I think of good faith, I think of real examples. I think of a hailstorm going through Anoka County, you know, last year, and neighborhoods where, you know, 12 out of 14 houses get roof and siding, and one particular individual gets a roof done but says, no, we're not going to pay on the siding. Well, two neighbors to one side, two neighbors to the other, everybody across the street all got that done, but guess what? You have the wrong insurance company. And so I think, you know, while I don't think we need to legislate penalties that, you know, go against those who are doing or acting in good faith, I do think that there needs to be some solution to help homeowners and individuals out there. And so I guess maybe my statement is just a statement, and maybe there isn't a question unless you care to comment on that, because my definition of good faith may not be the same that I've kind of heard kick around a little bit here today. So actually, I'm supporting the bill because I see it as a good faith definition from my point of view.
Okay, we have to go to the vote now. Representative Smith renews his motion to pass and re-refer to the Commerce Committee. Is that correct, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, that is my motion.
Okay, all in favor say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
Carries. Representative Cornish moves the minutes of the March 1st meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Carries. We are adjourned.